The following program is produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.
What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Reach.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Jeremy Ben-Ami, the president and founder of J Street, the controversial new liberal Jewish lobbying group working on behalf of Israel. We'll also have visits from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gilbert. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@Yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. Too Jewish is sponsored this morning by Temple Emmanuel, a Reformed Jewish community for all of Tucson. Call 327-4501 for information on Arizona's finest synagogue, the only full-service Reformed congregation in southern Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. It's a very musical week in Jewish tradition, which is cause to rejoice. This coming Sabbath in Temple is called Shabbat Shirah, the Sabbath of Song, coming as it does on the week in which we chant the great Song of Moses, the Az Yashir Moshe, in synagogue. This Torah portion is particularly associated with music, since the Hebrew words for song and poem are essentially the same, shir and shirah, and this poem of Moses was, well, sung. To many scholars, the passage known as the Song of Moses, the Az Yashir Moshe, is one of the oldest texts in the Hebrew Bible, making it one of the earliest pieces of religious literature still in use today and still relevant. And the delightful fact is that chanting or singing Torah, turning text to music, has been a central aspect of Jewish tradition for perhaps three millennia. Doing so with energy and joy is the way we take our theological ideas and raise them to the level of celebration. And so to play us in this morning, here's a contemporary Micha Mocha, a setting of the best-known text from that Song of Moses at the Sea for the coming of Shabbat Shirah this weekend. It's by cantors Dave Propus and Alan Naplin.
Micha Mocha Vailim Adonai, Micha Mocha Nedar Bakodesh Nora Nora, Nora Tehilo, O Sefele. Micha Mocha Vailim Adonai, Micha Mocha Nedar Bakodesh Nora Nora, Nora Tehilo, O Sefele. Malchutcha ravanecha, bokei ayam ifnei Moshe. Zeli, zeli, anu ve'ameru. Malchutcha ravanecha, bokei ayam ifnei Moshe. Zeli, zeli, anu ve'ameru.
Chamocha from this week's Torah portion from the CD, Thank God It's Shabbat, for the coming Sabbath of Song this Friday and Saturday. By the way, that Oz Yashir Moshe, that text I talked about, has a very special chant, distinct from the chant used for the rest of Torah. So that it begins, Oz Yashir Moshe uvnei Yisrael et ashira hazot ladonai v'yamrulei mor. That's all regular Torah chant. But then it goes, Ashira ladonai ki gao gao sus ferach far amavayam. And there's a variety of other embellishments and beautifications that are unique to this very passage. A way to take a lovely section of Torah and make it just gorgeous. Again, the Shabbat of Song, Shabbat Shira, this coming weekend. When we return in a few moments on Too Jewish, we'll meet our guest, Jeremy Ben-Ami, the founder of J Street, the pro-Israel lobbying group that has provoked more controversy in the American Jewish world than just about anything in recent years. Find out why when we come back on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. I was out and about the other day and noticed one of my favorite ice cream stores was out of business. Not only did it depress me because I was in the mood for mint chocolate chip, but it also got me to thinking, how does a hometown restaurant survive these days in a city changing as fast as Tucson? I mean, we got stores being forced out with big rents and huge chains coming in with even huger advertising budgets. It seems to me a place like Tucson kind of starts to lose its individuality. But don't lose faith. At Mama's, we're still your neighborhood pizza restaurant. If you've got a request or a problem, you don't need to call some fancy office in California. You just call Vinny or me or one of the kids and you're at the top. I'm not kidding. At Mama's, we have great tasting food at hometown prices, and we always will. Mama's Pizza with four convenient locations. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza!
We're delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Jeremy Ben-Ami, the president of J Street, the important and controversial newish group that has become kind of a counterpoint to the strong right-wing lobbying on behalf of Israel. Jeremy Ben-Ami served in a number of senior government positions. He was President Bill Clinton's deputy domestic policy advisor and the policy director on Howard Dean's presidential campaign. Recently senior vice president of Fenton Communications, and served as the communication director of the New Israel Fund. Jeremy, tell me, why did you decide to get involved in the creation of J Street?
Well, personally, I'm just deeply connected to and committed to the state of Israel. My great-grandparents were in the first Aliyah. My grandparents were founders of Tel Aviv. My father fought in the Irgun for Israeli independence. So it's been such a key part of my life, and I'm deeply concerned about the future of the state and the inability to end the conflict with the Palestinians and what that means for the prospects of there being a state of Israel for my kids and grandkids that is democratic and Jewish. And I think now is the moment that we have to organize and speak out and urge the president and others here to do what they can to end this conflict now. And so I felt that voice wasn't being heard, and we started J Street to make that case as forcefully as possible.
Do you see J Street as a counterpoint to AIPAC, or work closely with them, in opposition to them?
Well, I think it's a compliment to them. You know, I think that the role of AIPAC and the role of many of the traditional groups is to solidify the U.S.-Israel alliance and relationship and ensure aid and economic programs and cultural exchanges in a solid long-term relationship. But we're an advocacy group for a two-state solution to the end of this conflict. And we're willing to express when we don't agree with the government of Israel, as we don't on some of their settlement policies, and we're willing to say when we want to see more out of the U.S. government. And you know, that's not really the role of AIPAC, to challenge the government of Israel or to you know, push American policy into places that are a little less traditional. So we're a different type of group, but we agree with a lot of what AIPAC does stand for, and we push the envelope beyond where they're willing to go.
How do you respond to people who have for a long time said, look, you know, it's one thing to criticize Israel if you live in Israel, if you're serving in the military. It's another thing if you're Jews living outside of Israel to bring pressure to bear on Israel from an outside source?
Well, you know, number one, what we're talking about is what should American policy be? And so when there are people lobbying in Washington saying, you know, America's policy should be, you know, hands off and let the situation be, we want to make sure that American politicians and policymakers know that there's another group of Jewish Americans who don't want to see the American government hang back. You know, this is a question of American foreign policy, and we're American citizens, and we have every right and an almost an obligation to speak out on what the United States should do. I would also argue that the way this conversation plays out is extremely important for the future of the American Jewish community. And to the extent that those of us who have criticisms of Israeli policy and the direction that we're headed, you know, if we are told that we need to be quiet, that we're not supposed to speak out, then in fact, you know, there's some kind of a litmus test for what it means to be pro-Israel, that is going to undermine the health of the Jewish community here. And so we think it's important both for the United States as well as for us in the Jewish community here that there be an open and a vibrant debate and dialogue on these issues.
We will talk much more with Jeremy Ben-Ami, the president of J Street. Lots more to talk about, lots of controversy and deep interest when we come back on Too Jewish.
If your parents or other loved ones are in need of assisted living, consider making the choice that Dorothy Daniels' family made, Handmaker.
Living at Handmaker does make me feel very independent, like I was still in my house. The best part of it is I don't have to clean it.
Assisted living at Handmaker promotes an active and independent life. All needs are met, including weekly housekeeping and linen service, transportation to doctor's appointments, restaurants, banks, and shopping. And living at Handmaker is fun.
Every 2 weeks, there is a man who comes with a saxophone, and we dance, and I love that because I love to dance.
Handmaker is centrally located on Rosemont, just south of Grant, and includes 1 and 2 bedroom suites and cozy studios with patios and balconies.
I would recommend Handmaker to anyone because I feel very safe and secure here. The people that work here are very nice, considerate, and that means a lot.
For a tour and consultation, call 322-7035 or visit their website at handmaker.org.
Join us at Temple Emmanuel for a unique and delightful evening of great wines, a wonderful meal, and the most unusual and pleasant holiday celebration of the year. The Tu B'Shvat Wine Tasting Seder is coming to Temple Emmanuel on Friday, January 14th at 5:30 p.m. Tu B'Shvat celebrates the natural world and God's role in making it both beautiful and fertile. The Temple Emmanuel Tu B'Shvat Wine Tasting Seder, led by Rabbi Sam Kohan, features stories, songs, special foods, a delicious Shabbat dinner, and outstanding wines from the top kosher wineries in our taste-off of the best Israeli wines. Food and drink are from co-sponsors Pastiche, a modern eatery, and the new El Wine Bistro. The Tu B'Shvat Wine Tasting Seder is followed at 7:30 p.m. by an all-music service for Shabbat Shirah, the Sabbath of Song, featuring music of the great American Jewish composer Max Helfman. Registration includes all wine, food, and music. Call 327-4501 to sign up for the Tu B'Shvat Wine Tasting Seder at Temple Emmanuel on Friday night, January 14th. Call 327-4501 now to sign up.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can get CDs of past and present shows through the website or downloading us from the website or the Apple iTunes Store as popular podcasts. Well, it took more than 35 years, but the revelations coming out about the Nixon administration's anti-Semitic bias have finally developed to the point where even the great court Jew of the most hated administration in history, Henry Kissinger, has been quoted saying some pretty terrible things about Jews. In December, the Nixon Presidential Library and Museum released some new material. That is, they had transcribed some of the old tapes. It was revealed in them that Kissinger really outdid himself back in 1973 on the subject of Soviet Jewry, which was then locked into the status of prisoners of Zion behind the Iron Curtain of Soviet atheism and anti-Semitism. At one point, Kissinger said, "The immigration of Jews from the Soviet Union is not an objective of American foreign policy." And by the way, this is the crux of the matter in this quote, "If they put Jews into gas chambers in the Soviet Union, it is not an American concern. Maybe a humanitarian concern." Kissinger, who was then National Security Advisor, made the odious remarks on March 1, 1973, to President Nixon after Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir had requested American intervention on behalf of Soviet Jewry. Nixon's response was not much less disconcerting. "I know," he said, "we can't blow up the world because of it." As Menachem Rosenseft said in an editorial in the Jewish Week, Kissinger's comments sound a great deal like those of the notorious anti-Semite Father Coughlin during the 1930s. Now, Kissinger, in his own defense, noted that the remarks were taken out of context. Aren't they always in these cases? And that he's responding to the Jackson-Vanik Amendment, which at the time threatened the more subtle interests of realpolitik and détente, and that the amendment was actually impeding the ability of Soviet Jews to get out of Russia. Well, perhaps. Kissinger was and is a complicated man. He himself narrowly escaped the Holocaust in his own native Nazi Germany, the land of his birth and early years. He got out in 1937, and he retains that strong German-Jewish accent to this day. Kissinger lost 13 close relatives to the Holocaust. And of course, we have to remember that it was Nixon and Kissinger who airlifted emergency ammunition and fuel to Israel during the worst days of the Yom Kippur War, which helped the IDF turn the tide and save Israel. Whether it was Nixon or Kissinger who pushed for it is a hot debate among scholars, but clearly they did it. But wow, what a disgusting quote from Kissinger. What despicable reasoning. Of course, when you stop and think about it, our country has a long history of ignoring genocide, particularly during the 20th century. FDR refused to let Jews fleeing the Holocaust into the United States, and he chose not to bomb the trains that took so many Jews to Auschwitz. The Cambodian killing fields were undisturbed by American protests. We did nothing about Bosnia for years. We didn't intervene in Rwanda, and Darfur engaged us very little and, you know, still does. So it should come as no surprise that Kissinger essentially articulated what has been American public policy for the better part of a century. What other people do to their own citizens or their neighbor's citizens is of little concern to the U.S. unless it directly impacts our strategic interests. Yuck, but true. Still, for a Jew, the most prominent Jew in America at the time, the only Jew to serve as Secretary of State, as he did eventually, for a Jew to say, as Kissinger did, that if they put Jews into gas chambers in the Soviet Union, it is not an American concern, even after 37 years, it has the power to nauseate, doesn't it? You know, I'm just glad I'm not Henry Kissinger's rabbi. Clearly, though, he needs one. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbart. Good morning, Guy.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So you're from Haifa, which has some of the most beautiful beaches in Israel. I guess you're a beach guy, huh?
Well, I like the shore. I like the shore. I like the sea. And especially I like the sea on wintertime. I'm not so much of a summer guy in the sea. I don't like to swim in the sea so much. But on wintertime, when the sea is really...
kind of wild, isn't it?
Wild. And you see all those huge waves and the smell of the salt is in the air. That's when I love to go to the shoreline. And there is a lovely walkway along the Haifa shoreline. You can walk on your right-hand side. You have those very groovy restaurants and cafe places and some pubs, usually with great music. And on your left-hand side, you'll see the sea with the waves. And you just walk along. You know, you hear the music from the different cafes and different pubs. And you see the sea and you smell the smell. And a lot of people are walking back and forth. And everybody with their coats and with their, you know, umbrellas if it's a little bit rainy. It's not, usually it's not really rainy in Israel. It rains a little bit, like in Tucson. And I really love it. It has some, a little sad, but also very comforting feeling.
Sounds very Mediterranean to me. You know, we talk about Israel, we think of Israel as a place of profound history and tremendous religious meaning, but it's also a beautiful country on the shore of a beautiful ocean.
Yeah, it is. And usually one of the magical points you see if you go like near the sunset and you see the fishermen that are preparing for their nightly travel into the sea to find some fish. They prepare the boats, and some of the fishermen are standing on the rocks with, you know, trying to catch fishes straight from the rocks. And it's really, for me, it's really special. It gives a nice atmosphere.
I can smell the sea. I'm ready to go to the beach. I better leave right now. Thanks, Guy. We'll talk next week.
Okay, see you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the great restaurateur Janos Wilder of Janos Restaurant at the J Bar. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi. Please forgive me.
Oh, well, you know, I'm in that business.
I've opened another restaurant.
Downtown?
Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails, 135 South 6. I got to tell you, I am so excited about it. We have created an absolutely gorgeous space where the former Barrio Grill was located. And the food, well, you know my food.
Your food is the best I've ever had. Don't tell my wife. Although she agrees. So you're creating magic food, as she calls it, downtown. What's the best way for people to make reservations to try the new place?
Just give us a call at 623-7700 or go online at downtownkitchen.com. We're serving lunch Monday through Saturday, dinner 7 days a week, happy hour, late night Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and all with prices so low, you can afford to eat here every day.
I would love to. Thanks, Janos.
Thank you, Rabbi.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We are delighted to welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, back from more journeys, this time in South America. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi, and happy secular New Year.
Thank you very much, and a happy Rosh Hashanah L'Chilonim to you, a secular New Year as well. One of the really interesting stories, or I'm not sure if it's interesting, that came out at the end of last year, and it's continuing into January, is Latin American countries recognizing Palestine as a country. And there are now something like 130, supposedly, countries that have recognized Palestine. But what does that really mean? I'm not really sure I even understand what diplomatic recognition means.
All right, great question. I would like, with your permission, to divide my response into two different parts.
By all
means. What, you haven't heard the two different parts yet.
I just trust you.
That's very kind. One is the whole question of diplomatic recognition, and the other is Latin America and its Jewish communities. Okay, so on the question of diplomatic recognition, it's a serious political tool in the sense that a country or a state or an entity which doesn't get diplomatic recognition by anybody, in a certain sense, doesn't exist. It has no, it's a ghost. It has no presence on the international stage. It can't join the UN. You need a critical mass of countries to recognize you in order to be taken seriously as a country. So, for example, to take something closer to home, when Israel was first declared a state by the United Nations, and it declared its own independence. One of its first priorities, besides simple survival and winning the war against its neighbors, was to gain diplomatic recognition from as many countries as possible. This was a key priority. Another example, more recent, when Afghanistan was divided into 6 or 8 different warring factions, each led by warlords, each group of warlords tried to get diplomatic recognition as the head of the legitimate government of Afghanistan, the state of Afghanistan. And the U.S. position always was, we recognize states, not governments. So we recognize the existence of Afghanistan. We don't grant or withhold recognition from a particular government. But, for example, so India clearly recognizes the state of Palestine because the state of Palestine has a huge, beautiful embassy in New Delhi, which it can't open without diplomatic recognition. It has no diplomatic status without recognition. Now, you might ask, a country or an entity like the Palestinian Authority that cannot feed, educate, or clothe its people, why should it open a huge, expensive embassy in New Delhi, and who's paying for that? Well, the answer to the second question is probably the Saudis. The answer to the first is this whole thing of legitimacy being taken seriously as a state. So the more countries that grant recognition, the more substance there is to the claim that a state exists. And conversely, if countries withhold or withdraw diplomatic recognition, the state in some sense doesn't really exist. So I hope that clears up part of your question.
Well, I hope it does too, and maybe we'll come back to this next week because I'm still wondering how an undeclared country can have embassies all around the world, and maybe you'll clarify this muddy water for us further. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
And now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Moshe works in a fine haberdashery, a men's clothing store. One day, his boss returns from lunch and notices Moshe's hand is bandaged. Moshe tells him that he has some good news to report. I finally sold that ridiculous suit we've had for such a long time. Do you mean that bright orange and blue double-breasted thing? Says his boss. That's the one, says Moshe. Mazel tov, his boss says. I really thought we'd never get rid of it. It was the ugliest suit I've ever seen. But tell me, Moshe, why is your hand bandaged? Simple, Moshe replies. As soon as I sold the suit to the gentleman, his guide dog bit me. That was the old Jewish joke of the week. A new one this time. A special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the wonderful Torah portion of B'Shalach, the great tale of the Exodus from Egypt. The story is familiar from Bible class, sermons, Passover seders, movies, even cartoons. The Israelites, under the leadership of Moses, with help from his brother Aaron and sister Miriam, have been liberated from Egyptian slavery. God has sent the 10 plagues to destroy the will of the oppressors, and now our people escapes Egypt after 400 years of slavery with small bundles of clothing, a little unleavened bread baked in haste, and a few trinkets of gold and silver borrowed from their former slavers. The Israelites approach the sea. Some say it was the Sea of Reeds, some the Red Sea, and Pharaoh has a change of heart and mind. He decides cruelly to follow the Israelites with his chariot army and re-enslave them. Stuck on the shore of the sea between the oncoming enemy and the deep water, God miraculously saves the Israelites, dividing the sea, allowing them to cross on dry land, with the waters closing up behind them to destroy their Egyptian pursuers. As they look back on the now unparted waters, the Israelites celebrate and sing a great song. Who is like you, God, among the gods who are worshipped? Who is like you, adorned in holiness, awesome in praise, who does wonders? Mi Chamocha by Lim Adonai. That song is part of every evening and morning service in Jewish tradition, the Mi Chamocha. It is often sung in an upbeat, joyous, energizing way. for in that very moment our people fully comprehended the miraculous saving power of God, the amazing ability to be redeemed from death and destruction. While it doesn't always turn out that way, it does remind us that in Jewish belief, God can do anything and has done so for our people at rare but remarkable times. It's not something to count on in daily life, although David Ben-Gurion, the founding prime minister of Israel and the true father of the country, memorably said, "In Israel, in order to be a realist, you must believe in miracles." God's capacity for miracles does exist and is actualized in this portion to demonstrate that freedom can come even to the most downtrodden and enslaved people in the world. Ben-Gurion also said, "Anyone who doesn't believe you can't change history has never written his memoirs." One of the great aspects of the portion of B'Shalach is that as soon as the story of the Exodus and the crossing of the sea are told in prose form, there's an immediate reinterpretation in poetry. And we have been reinterpreting this fantastic tale ever since. We'll do it again, not only this Shabbat, but on Passover, coming not too long. It's all very close to the heart of Judaism and Jewish life. And it's also a wonderful lesson that's been taken to heart by nearly every liberation movement since the Exodus, well over 3,000 years ago. No matter how dark the prospects for freedom may seem, sometimes, often, God makes it possible for slaves to become free. Our Jewish poetry slam this morning is on the theme of Exodus, that is, leaving, going outward to a new reality, abandoning what we've known. Marge Piercy's poem, Magid. The courage to let go of the door, the handle. The courage to shed the familiar walls whose very stains and leaks are comfortable as the little moles of the upper arm. Stains that recall a feast, a child's naughtiness, a loud, blattering storm that slapped the roof hard, pouring through. The courage to abandon graves dug into the hill. The small bones of children and the brittle bones of the old, whose marrow hunger had stolen. The courage to desert the tree planted and only begun to bear. The riverside where promises were shaped, the street where their empty pots were broken. The courage to leave the place whose language you learned as early as your own, whose customs, however dangerous or demeaning, bind you like a halter you have learned to pull inside, to move your load. The land fertile with the blood spilled on it, the roads mapped and annotated for survival. The courage to walk out of the pain that is known, into the pain that cannot be imagined, mapless, going barefoot without a canteen, into the desert. We honor those who let go of everything but freedom, who ran, who revolted, who fought, who became other by saving themselves. That's the poem Magid by Marge Piercy about the Exodus. When we come back on Too Jewish, the founder of the very controversial new lobbying group J Street, Jeremy Ben-Ami, will explain just what prompted the creation of J Street and how it differs from other Jewish organizations and why he thinks it's better. All that when we return on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Former Israeli President Moshe Katsav was convicted of rape just before the end of 2010, a dramatic fall from grace for a man who rose from humble beginnings to become a symbol of achievement for Jews of Sephardic and Edot HaMizrach, Middle Eastern origin. The disgraced politician Katsav, who rejected a plea bargain that would have kept him out of jail, will likely be sentenced to somewhere between 4 and 16 years in prison. The verdict is a victory for the Israeli legal system and for women's rights in a long struggle to chip away at the nation's macho culture. The court sent two clear and sharp messages that everyone is equal and every woman has the full right to her body, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said. But he added that it was a sad day for Israel and its citizens, and it certainly was. Tel Aviv District Court found Katsav, who is 65 years old, guilty of two counts of raping an employee in 1998, back when he was Israel's tourism minister. It also convicted him of lesser counts of indecent acts, sexual harassment of two other women who worked for him when he was president, and obstruction of justice. Katsav denied all the allegations, claiming he was a victim of a political witch hunt, suggesting he was targeted because he's a Sephardic Jew. But the ruling of the three-judge panel said that his version of events was strewn with lies. Moshe Katsav was ordered to surrender his passport while he awaits sentencing. The presidency of Israel is a largely ceremonial post, traditionally given to elder statesmen as a reward for a lifetime of public service. Winning the office capped a career in which Katsav became a model of success for Sephardic Jews, who for decades were a kind of Jewish underclass in Israel relative to the European-rooted Ashkenazic establishment. Katsav's world began to crumble very late in his presidency when he complained that a female employee was trying to extort him. The woman went to the police with her side of the story, detailing a series of sexual assaults. Other women came forward. According to the indictment, Katsav forced one woman to the floor of his office at the tourism ministry back in 1998 and raped her. Later that year, he summoned her to a Jerusalem hotel to go over paperwork and raped her again on the bed in his room. The indictment alleges that he harassed two women while he was president, embracing them against their will and making unwanted sexual comments. Katsav was also charged with obstruction of justice for trying to persuade one of the women to change her testimony. Under heavy public pressure, as reported on Too Jewish, Katsav resigned from the office of the presidency in 2007, just 2 weeks before his term would have expired, under a plea bargain that would have required him to admit to lesser charges of sexual misconduct. And then Katsav, well, lost his mind, rejected the deal, and vowed to clear his name in court. He had a bizarre news conference back then, lashing out at prosecutors in the media, denying wrongdoing, waving a computer disc that he said proved his innocence, screaming at reporters, and so on. The Israeli public has closely followed the Katsav case's twists and salacious turns. The conviction of a former president on rape charges, virtually unheard of anywhere in the world, was shocking. It is the latest victory both for the right of law and for women's rights groups against the male-dominated establishment in Israel, an establishment that is changing. In Latin America, a fourth country, Bolivia, has chosen to recognize the undeclared state of Palestine, joining Brazil, Argentina, and Uruguay. The Bolivian declaration, like those of the other countries, recognizes a Palestinian state in line with the 1967 borders, the so-called Green Line. While Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas lauded the move and the Israeli Foreign Ministry condemned it, it is not clear what impact it will really have. Israel is concerned that if Mexico joins the ranks of the Latin American countries recognizing Palestine, the wave will be unstoppable. In a world in which many countries still pretend that Israel, a nation voted into existence by the United Nations, doesn't exist, it's a little hard to see that this is much of a new challenge for the Jewish state, but it clearly raises some issues. It should be noted, however, that according to some tallies, already 130 countries have recognized the Palestinian statelet. As always, actual full independence for Palestine, or whatever it ends up being called, will come as the result of direct negotiations with Israel and will require some serious concessions on both sides, not just Israel's. In other news, a Polish court sentenced a Swedish guy to nearly 3 years in prison for masterminding the theft of the infamous Arbet Macht Frei sign from the entry gate of the former Nazi death camp at Auschwitz. The sign, an enduring symbol of the Holocaust whose English meaning is "work sets you free," was stolen in December of 2009, triggering international outrage, especially in Israel and among Jewish groups, but it was soon recovered. The court in Krakow in southern Poland sentenced Anders Hogstrom, 34, to 2 years and 8 months in jail for orchestrating the theft. When the court announced his decision, Hogstrom said calmly, "I accept the verdict." Hogstrom, caught in Sweden in February, will shortly be extradited back home to serve out the remainder of his sentence. The Krakow court also handed down jail sentences of up to 2.5 years to two Poles who stole the metal sign and cut it into three pieces to fit into their car. The sign has been repaired. It is now on display in the Auschwitz Museum, however, while a replica hangs over the entrance gate to the former death camp. 1.5 million people, mostly Jews, were murdered by the Nazis at Auschwitz-Birkenau, located near the village of Oswiecim, close to Krakow, during World War II. Prisoners arriving at the camp entered via the relatively small iron gate, topped by that German language motto. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We're delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Jeremy Ben-Ami. He's the president of J Street, which has been in the news a whole bunch in the year and change since its founding. Came to J Street from a 25-year career in government, politics, and communication, both in the United States and in Israel. He has served in a number of senior government positions in the U.S., President Bill Clinton's deputy domestic policy advisor. He was the policy director on Howard Dean's presidential campaign and was a senior vice president of Fenton Communications. Also served as a communications director for the New Israel Fund and started the Israeli firm Ben Ora Communications when he lived in Israel in the late 1990s. Boy, considering the pace of change in Israel, the late 1990s must seem like ancient history nowadays, doesn't it?
An enormous amount has changed. It's a different Israeli society in so many ways since I lived there. I lived there for 3 years, and it was the heyday of the peace process. And I think all of the parties expected that we were headed towards a resolution, and the time was on our side, and we knew where things were going to end up. And it was just a matter of crossing the T's and dotting the I's, and we'd eventually get there. And I think the perception today is that time has shifted, and time is now working against us. It's no longer our friend. There's no guarantees that we're going to get to the end of this conflict in a reasonable manner. And time's running out on the chances for a two-state solution to the conflict. And with it go the chances of Israel remaining both a democracy and the national home of the Jewish people.
You know, I remember both living in Israel in the early 90s, beginning of the Oslo process, and then being there in the late 90s when people were talking about it's just next year we're going to plan trips to Syria and Lebanon, vacations. Are you really sure that things have turned so 180 degrees the other direction and that we're just as correct now as we thought we were then?
Well, I think that the important lesson of all of this is how fast things can change. I think that the notion that in 15, 20 years, there are relationships and friendships and business ties that could be established in a very positive atmosphere in the region is not so far-fetched. It can swing that fast and that far. I think the bleak outlook today is probably correct. There isn't a clear path out. You have clear political issues both in the Israeli side and on the Palestinian side that are real obstacles to resolving the conflict. But should we get past those obstacles, I don't think that there's any reason why one couldn't quickly return back to an era in which people are seeing real possible benefits and positives to coexistence and to peace.
J Street has been controversial since its founding. Anything new in the Jewish world, of course, is always controversial. What do you say to the people who question whether there was a need for J Street?
Well, I think the fact that we have over 160,000 people who've joined our effort in just a couple of years is a signal that there was a real vacuum here. We've gone from a couple of people in my basement with a laptop to an organization of 45 staff and a $7 million budget and presence in 40 communities around the country through grassroots chapters that we've started. This is a voice that was missing and a home in the Jewish community where people can feel that they can express their love for Israel and a deep abiding commitment to its existence and security, but also have an open discussion about whether or not the government there and the government here are doing everything that is possible and necessary in order to secure its future in peace with its neighbors.
Do you feel, and this is the, you know, constant argument, that there is a Palestinian partner in peace? Or let me put it a different way, is that the most important question?
Well, I think that the folks who are in charge of the Palestinian Authority now, whether it's the President Mahmoud Abbas or the particularly the Prime Minister Salam Fayyad, are as good a partner as we are going to get in order to try to end this conflict. I don't think that there's any point in holding back if people want to take the chances for resolution. These are the folks who have been committed their entire lives to achieving a peaceful, negotiated resolution to the conflict. If we don't achieve a result with this generation of leaders and this group of leaders, the people that would come to power are far less likely to be willing to engage in diplomacy and probably, you know, to view a two-state solution as really the answer. So I think it's probably not the right question, because this is about as good as we're going to get. These folks are terrific. I mean, Salam Fayyad is building up a security force, an economy. Abbas has laid out, you know, numerous times his vision of what a two-state solution looks like and has put his political career on the line. So I think that, you know, we should probably look very closely at what our alternatives are to dealing with these folks rather than trying to wait for you know, the second coming of Gandhi or of Mandela.
We're more likely to get the second coming of Hamas in the West Bank. Is that sort of the perspective?
Exactly. And also, you know, somebody like an Arafat, too, who just couldn't do it.
Just couldn't close the deal.
Right. You know, and couldn't bring himself to make the compromises and to lead the people. And that's, you know, what we've seen. It's what we are likely to get again. And, you know, we're really, I think, blessed in a way by having someone like a Salam Fayyad, who is, you know, trusted and respected by the Israeli security teams and the professionals as to what he's able to do and what they have accomplished in just the last 5 years.
J Street has been in the news a lot in the last couple of months based on the support that George Soros has provided. Talk a little bit about that swirling controversy.
Well, you know, I'll just say up front, we're very proud to have the support of George Soros for our work. There's been controversy over whether or not we needed to make public his support and all of our donors, as a matter of fact. And so I've apologized personally if I personally and the organization have misled people. But the issues that need to be discussed are not the funding and the financing behind J Street, but the route forward to saving Israel's future and the distraction that some on the right of our community hope to create by discussing our funding is to avoid the tough questions about how do we secure Israel's future.
John Stewart, I believe, said that, you know, where you can criticize Israel whenever you want to without fear of repercussion? Israel. Israel is a country with a very vibrant and highly critical free press, not to mention what gets said on the floor of the Knesset. Do you think that the role of Americans who support Israel, which is the vast majority of American Jews, is to be similarly open in their criticism, or does there need to be some discretion employed?
Well, I think the starting point for the Jewish community here in this country is a very clear, rock-solid commitment to the existence and the security of a national home for the Jewish people, and that we would, no matter what our prescriptions are for how best to you know, achieve that future, there's no doubt that we want to convey to everybody, from the, you know, president to the Congress and everywhere else, a rock solid support for the existence and the security of that national home for our people. So that, I think, is something where we wouldn't want to have anybody have an impression other than unity. But beyond that, there is no reason why we can't have a good, solid, old-fashioned Jewish argument. You know, three opinions, two Jews. You know, this is a classic way we function as a community, and we're going to disagree. We're going to have a diversity of views, and that's okay. And it actually makes our relationship with each other, with our community, and with Israel stronger to allow people to have that conversation and that set of views expressed.
What do you think is the most dangerous issue facing Israel today?
There are several important threats. At its heart, I would say the number one threat is the possible failure to resolve this conflict with the Palestinian people, because over time, the lack of a two-state solution leads to an inevitability, which is that there will be more non-Jews than Jews in the land between the Jordan and the Mediterranean, and if the Jews maintain political control, they have to sacrifice their democracy. And then it becomes the kind of a state that we will have real problems relating to and supporting and feeling good about as the national home of our people. That's the biggest threat, and Ehud Barak, the defense minister, just laid that out the other day again, versus another very, very serious set of threats, which are coming from its neighbors, Iran on the one hand, or Hamas and Hezbollah with their rockets in Lebanon and Gaza. These are serious military threats, but they can be addressed, and they can certainly be lessened if Israel settles its conflict with the Palestinian people. All of the physical security threats will at least be somewhat tempered if the political question is addressed and dealt with fairly, appropriately, and quickly.
You know, it's funny because, of course, the answer that you'll get from many Israeli authorities and from others who work on behalf of Israel was that Iran is the great threat, the great nuclear threat. They often will sort of just kind of leave the Palestinian problem where it is. Why do you think they do that?
Well, it's a much harder threat to deal with. The notion of rallying around an external threat like Iran, or rallying against the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement, and what is now being called delegitimization, rallying against those external enemies and saying, we're good, they're bad, that's a lot easier communal conversation and a lot easier dynamic. But when the question is, what do we need to do in order to address a threat that's actually within our power to address, then you have a lot more difficult conversation, and people are less likely to want to have that conversation. They're less comfortable with it, and we can all agree to, you know, on who our common enemies are. It's a lot harder to agree comfortably on what we should be doing.
What do you think the greatest opportunity is for Israel right now?
Well, it's the inverse. You know, the achievement, if Israel were to put on the table the generally accepted resolution of the conflict, and to say we are willing as a country to give back 100% of the land with some land swaps that allow us to keep the settlement blocks, and we're willing to have a Palestinian capital in East Jerusalem as long as we can keep the Jewish neighborhoods that are there. If Israel were to put that kind of a deal on the table, it would immediately stop a whole lot of the delegitimization that's going on by countries and people and institutions who don't think Israel's aware of what it needs to do and the things that are going wrong. It would also, if that deal can be closed, allow a coalition of moderates in the region, Arab as well as Jewish, to band together in a common front and a united front against Iran, which is a common enemy that it was clear from the WikiLeaks of just a few weeks ago. You know, the Arab diplomats in the area clearly see Iran as a threat, and it would allow solving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict will allow Israel to work together towards that joint interest with its neighbors in a realignment, a real strategic realignment of the region.
I want to thank, by the way, I appreciate the sound effects of the sirens behind you as we talked about the threat to the region. It's very helpful.
Those are the alarm bells ringing, saying that Israel has to solve this conflict now or its future is at stake.
That's right, and everybody should join J Street as well.
Exactly.
JStreet.org. JStreet.org. I want to thank Jeremy Ben-Ami for a great visit here on Two Jewish. We would love to call you again when there's something hot on the table.
Anytime.
Great. Thanks, Jeremy. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical playout.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Join us at Temple Emmanuel for a unique and delightful evening of great wines, a wonderful meal, and the most unusual and pleasant holiday celebration of the year. The Tu B'Shvat Wine Tasting Seder is coming to Temple Emmanuel on Friday, January 14th at 5:30 p.m. Tu B'Shvat celebrates the natural world and God's role in making it both beautiful and fertile. The Temple Emmanuel Tu B'Shvat Wine Tasting Seder, led by Rabbi Sam Kohan, features stories, songs, special foods, a delicious Shabbat dinner, and outstanding wines from the top kosher wineries in our taste-off of the best Israeli wines. Food and drink are from co-sponsors Pastiche, a modern eatery, and the new El Wine Bistro. The Tu B'Shvat Wine Tasting Seder is followed at 7:30 p.m. by an all-music service for Shabbat Shirah, the Sabbath of Song, featuring music of the great American Jewish composer Max Helfman. Registration includes all wine, food, and music. Call 327-4501 to sign up for the Tu B'Shvat Wine Tasting Seder at Temple Emmanuel on Friday night, January 14th. Call 327-4501 now to sign up.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Next week, our guest will be the brilliant and beautiful Israeli journalist Natasha Mozgovaya, the chief U.S. correspondent for Haaretz newspaper. Our playout this morning comes from the text of this week's Torah portion for Shabbat Shirah, Ashira Ladonai, I will sing to God, from the animated Exodus story, The Prince of Egypt. Believe it or not. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
The preceding program was produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.